Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 23 of a year-long conversation. Are we safer in general? Michael, how's it going?
Well, going great.
Well, I wish I could say the same. The darkness is upon us, warming over me. I can barely move. Of course, I'm referring to my 30th birthday, which was last weekend. Not sure how it happened. I mean, it just came out of nowhere, and much like the terrorist attacks we're about to talk about and get into, 30 just struck out on me and hit me like a bullet.
Just embrace it. 30 is a great year. Some of my fondest memories of having 30.
I wish I could share your right-out optimism. Might spend the rest of the week crying after we get off this podcast.
I've had probably fewer than about 35 suicide attempts during my 30th. Thanks to my wonderful career, but you know, like I said, I don't know if that says more about my profession or more about my age.
People were like, "What did you do?" 30. And I was like, "Well, I sat in a room and played The Sound of Silence over and over again and cried into a pillow, pretty much."
But 30 will be a great year for you.
What better time to talk about pessimism than to get into the neocon movement? We kicked off our trilogy of conservatism, and we talked about social conservatives, and this week we're going to talk about military conservatives. Next week will be fiscal conservatives. Really, the general theme is, are we safer? If you listen to Republicans, and they seem to promote this idea that Obama's incompetent, that he can't do anything right, that his foreign policy has been a disaster, because now that the economy is kind of picked up, they can't really use the economy against him. And that, although they still try to use the economy, but it's become a weaker argument than this idea that we are unsafe and under attack and everything's being threatened. And so you seem to get the general idea that we're less safe since Obama took office, that we're now in a weaker position in the world. And I definitely don't think that that's true.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, I think when you look at the threat that we have today, I don't think it's the traditional threats that people are used to. Like,
right.
Obviously, we don't have any Hitlers in the world right now. We don't have Japan building an imperial navy.
Oh, you know about Gaddafi's ghost? He's Hitler's,
That's true. That's true. But we're not looking at these traditional powers that people are used to. So some of the threats that we're faced with is things that it's hard to really put a face with. Cyber terrorism, these threats that are difficult to face. I mean, it's really hard to say whether or not we're safer or not.
Yeah, I think when we talk about the three types of conservatives, social, military, and fiscal, basically Republicans are very predictable. They have a Rolodex of threats, and whenever they want to win an election, it's all fear-based because they can't really sell people on a positive idea of the future, because the idea of, like, depriving gay people from getting married, that's not really, like, a positive idea for the future. That's more like we're going to keep things the way they've always been. Basically, Democrats offer to a new vision, and Republicans, they run these fear-based campaigns, and the general thing that they're protecting you from gangs, immigrants, terrorists, gay marriage, debt. In general, they're protecting you from the future. What they're really running on is, like, the protection from the future. And right now, they can't really run on the economy. By any measure of success, people think it's better than when Bush was president. Like, there's no real way you can say the economy is worse than the end of the Bush presidency. And they kind of can't really focus on the moral values, because most of America doesn't agree with that anymore. In a national election, if they focused on the idea of social conservatism, they're only getting people that they would get anyway. Most swing voters now either are completely neutral to gay marriage, like they don't care about it, or they're for gay marriage. They can't really use these social issues right now, so the biggest thing that they've really got going for them is also the hardest to prove, which is this abstract, nebulous threat from overseas. Terrorism, cyber terrorism, Russia, just in general, these kind of threats that the Cold War went on for decades, and it was always kind of hard to prove how close are we to a nuclear war with Russia? How close are we to our own extinction, basically? It's a very nebulous threat, just this idea that's kind of like, ooh, could be Russia. I mean, throw it out there. It's just in the air. It's hard to really judge, like, how close are we to a terrorist attack, or, like, how big a threat is ISIS really, and how, because there could be a lone wolf attack, there could be coordinated attacks, there could be this thing, go years without even having one. But by just putting that threat out there, people feel threatened. So I think that it's very hard to prove that you're safe. Yeah. Safety is the hardest thing to prove versus, like, the economy, where there's actual numbers and they can poll if gay marriage and abortion are popular. But, like, safety is one of those very – we live in a country like the United States that actually is very safe, regardless of what people think. Safety is almost abstract. You can feel, like, threats become more and more abstract.
and a lot of it comes from we're pretty isolated with two friendly neighbors. I mean, we don't have bombs dropping over our country, you know, or drones flying over us every other day like a lot of these countries in Europe and Asia. So
right.
Yeah, it's easy to feel safe.
The last major terrorist attack was in Belgium. And the week of the Belgium terrorist attacks, somehow America made that all about us and about how we're not safe and we're a threat and we don't have the right safety and everything. And I thought, like, it's now gotten to a place where our safety is tied to the fate of countries that are overseas. So it's not even tied to our domestic safety is tied to countries overseas. And there could be a terrorist attack in Belgium, and the people in Cincinnati are like, oh, my God, that could be us next or whatever. Like, it doesn't even have to happen on American soil for us to feel threat. The week of the Belgium terrorist attacks, Trump's poll numbers, they went up, and he was popping all this stuff or whatever. I mean, there hasn't been a major terrorist attack since 9/11, knock on wood.
Right.
I mean, that's 15 years ago. When you have to basically talk about 15 years ago as your last point of, like, real unsafety and danger and threat and security levels, I think that's pretty good. Like, I think I know it's pretty good. Most countries would kill for that. Imagine any majority Muslim country from Syria to Nigeria to Pakistan being like 15 years without a terrorist attack. What is this, heaven? Like, what is this? Like, is this the afterlife? For most countries, they couldn't believe having that kind of safety.
People in Nigeria are like, 15 days, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it would be tough. When we talk about, are we safer? I honestly don't see how you could say we're not. But somehow Republicans have made it all about, well, because ISIS killed somebody over in Syria. Like, a lot of times when they blame Obama for ISIS, and they blame, it's sort of like they're saying nothing bad should happen in the world ever. Anything bad that happens in the world is the American president's fault.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, because if we don't have our military in every single country covering every square inch of the world, then obviously it's our fault.
Right. America's a strange place in terms of, like, the way the rest of the world views us. When you see other countries, they're like, ugh, America. And then, I mean, like, America's not popular until they need us to do something. And then we're the first place that they go to. Like, you'll see a country in the Middle East, Europe, it could be anywhere. Sticking their nose where it doesn't belong. And then the second they have a civil war, stick your nose where it doesn't belong. Save us. Like, they don't like American intervention until they desperately need it. And then they don't hesitate to. It's a weird double game. Like, in Afghanistan, we're finally starting to pull some of our troops out. And for 15 years, all you heard from Afghanistan was, we don't want America here. Why are they here? Why are they here? And then now that we're leaving, they're almost like, fine, go. We don't care. We thought you'd be around longer, but whatever. It doesn't matter to us. You know, I mean, it's like a spouse who drives you out of the house, and then when you leave, it's like, I can't believe they left. Fine, go, asshole, leave. I can't believe you. You know, Afghanistan just feels like some terrible, like, it's like a marriage that should get a divorce. And, like, America is going to have to sneak out in the middle of the night one time. You know, like, they're going to just literally, like, sneak out in the middle of the night and take their tanks and everything, and Afghanistan is going to be like, I knew they would leave eventually. It's fine. I've been on my own before. I'll survive. It's such a dysfunctional relationship. And whenever I see a documentary of Afghanistan, I mean, the Afghanistan military, they literally go in a minute's time span from being like, America, blah, 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 they're part of the problem, and they need to leave, and we need to stand on our own. And then you start talking about, well, America's scheduled to leave next month. Next month? What? I meant like 15 years from now. It's a weird double game where everything's our fault. If we interfere, it's our fault. And if we don't interfere, it's also our fault. Like, everything's our fault, no matter what happens. And I think the Republican Party has taken that international mantra and absorbed it. They only absorb it when the Democrats in the White House. Like, when Obama's in the White House, it's like, oh, he didn't do enough in Syria. And then when George W. Bush is in the White House and he invades Iraq for no reason, what do you want? The guy's not God. He can't know everything that's going to happen ahead of time. I mean, like, no matter what Bush did, it wasn't his fault somehow. And yet in Obama, it's like, why didn't Obama get in the time machine, stop the Syrian civil war before it started? What was he thinking, letting the Syrian civil war happen that had nothing to do with us? How could he allow that to happen? And then with Bush, it's like, well, he invaded the wrong country. He's not perfect, Brody. Like, nobody can know everything. And with Alabama Republicans, when Bush was in the White House, it was like, no matter what the guy did, I mean, no matter what he did, it wasn't his fault. Cut the guy a break. And I thought, hey, he's the son of a president who's fucked up for 8 years. How much more of a break can you cut somebody, Bush? I don't feel sorry for him. And yet with Obama, anything that happens, it's his fault. And even stuff that has no direct relation to America, is his fault. The Arab Spring happened in Libya. That had absolutely nothing to do with America, but somehow they tied it to Obama wasn't strong enough. It was inevitable. Bush presidency. We mentioned it a little bit last week where there was the documentary I saw called The Power of Nightmares, where Adam Curtis, this documentarian, he kind of laid out like the neocons and Islamic terrorism and Islamic radicalism, they need each other. They feed off each other. So like the American military becomes more Christian. Like after 9/11, the American military become more Christian, and they've had a lot of stories about this, about how now military bases are essentially evangelical recruiting stations, and they become more religious. They drop a bomb in a school in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda uses that as an excuse to recruit 50 new people. The 50 new people commit a terrorist attack on a military base in Kabul or something. Then the American military becomes more radicalized, and so they kind of need each other to basically keep going. I mean, if you basically got rid of the threat from Islamic radicalism, or you didn't have Islam at all, like if it just totally disappeared, and then the choice would be between evangelical Christian or agnostic, and I think most people would just choose no religion. They would be more agnostic than anything. When we talk about are we safer, like the neocon approach of like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, I mean, I don't see how you could say that that makes us safer than Bill Clinton and Obama.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think there's really no way to say that we are safer, but you're still not going to stop these neocons from using that argument. I mean, they're going to come up with something. They're going to come up with some argument to justify their cause.
One thing that was interesting was during the Republican primary debates, if you had listened to what they said, apparently, like, Russia's going to invade tomorrow, and we got to have a bigger and bigger military to fight them. Rubio talked about $1 trillion in new military spending. We already spend more than the 7 countries combined or something like that on our military. It seems like they're for total cutting out the government waste, but when it comes to the Pentagon, here, write Lockheed Martin a blank check, let them go crazy with it. It's the biggest source of waste in the entire government. Sometimes the Pentagon be like, we don't even want these weapons. And the Republican Congress says, you're going to get them anyway.
Yeah, you know, you're going
to
take them.
The Pentagon will go to Congress and say, we don't want it, we can't use it, we don't need it. And the Republicans are like, you're saying you need more tanks. They're like, no, more tanks, more aircraft carriers, more airplanes. I'm not talking millions, I'm talking about hundreds of billions of dollars wasted on new types of jet planes that don't even work and can't even fly.
Yeah, it's ridiculous when you look at the budget of the military. And it goes, like you were saying, it goes completely against what a lot of fiscal conservatives would argue for, how they're wanting to cut government spending, but they ignore the literal elephant in the room of military spending.
When you look at the three conservative groups, they don't seem to have that much overlap. Like when you have social conservatives, they supposedly care about not killing people, supposedly. Then the neocons are all about killing people.
Yeah.
And then you look at neocons, and their kind of argument is about spending ourselves broke on the military and everything the military needs to protect us, do more of it. And that seems to fly directly in the face of fiscal conservatives and libertarians.
Yeah.
Cutting out government waste. I mean, if you look at specific projects, Lockheed Martin might spend $100 billion on a fighter plane that does not work, and they haven't produced a single usable model. That would seem to be a pretty great place to start cutting.
Yeah.
And especially because most of these weapons, best case scenario, they do work. We're still spending money to fight the Russians in 1978. There's a project for a rail gun on one of the Navy ships that is, like, astronomical. They estimate it'll be $500 billion to finish these rail guns on all of our Navy ships. When was the last time we were even in a fucking naval war? I mean, it's been like 50 years ago. We even needed naval ships and a naval warfare. And basically, we're still like, oh, the rail guns, this will be able to punch a hole in a ship that doesn't exist. Our enemies don't even have the technology to fight what we're building for.
Are you telling me ISIS doesn't have a navy?
Yeah, a bunch of fucking goons that are only good. They're out there with potato guns out in the middle of the desert and shit. And it's like, there's like a desert army of fucking sheep farmers that lost their jobs because of global warming. This is what happened in Syria. There was a drought, and climate crisis forced all these farmers who had no crops, all their crops died, into Damascus. They had to go into the cities to start basically trying to find work, and it created all this instability. Pretty soon, the 75% of Syria that's Sunni, they looked at the tiny 10% Alawite population that basically controlled the military and the economy and all the money and all the international stuff, and said, oh, wait a minute. Wow, they controlled everything, and we're the majority of the country.
Yeah.
And they started the Syrian Civil War, and it was going on. And then ISIS showed up into a civil war that had already been going on. So it's not even like they really started this war. They start, and ISIS only moved into territories that the Sunni insurgency has already claimed anyway and basically take them over. They have not really been that responsible for the fighting that goes on. But yet, float this to Republicans are like, so you're saying that we need a new type of aircraft carrier to fight ISIS? You know, it's like, no, you're not hearing it. The threats that we're building these weapons for don't exist. It's like Republicans saw Independence Day and they took it literally, and we're really building weapons for aliens. The only thing that makes sense with some of these weapons are if they saw Battleship, the movie, Independence Day, War of the Worlds, and they're building weapons like, we need these new naval ships with rail guns to fight the alien invasion that's going to happen when, I mean, we can't rely on Liam Neeson by himself to do it all for us. We got to be able to fight. The board game Battleship got started as like in Cold War tensions for Russia and America, and when they had to make the movie Battleship, they didn't even use Russians. They used aliens. Because they knew the Russians were so far behind us in technology. The only credible threat to the American Navy was an alien race of people. So, like, the largest Navy in the world is the American Navy. The second largest Navy in the world is the Air Force. I mean, I feel like we're going to get to a place where 50 years from now, like, our different branches of the military are going to fight each other. You're going to have the Army and the Marines, and they're going to go to war. And then the Navy and the Air Force, they're going to go to war. And that'd be the only people who could, like, different branches of the military going to war would be the only, like, challenge or whatever. And meanwhile, we're not fighting the threats that actually exist. You mentioned cyber terrorism. They said America, like, we barely spend a penny on like cyber intelligence and networks and cyber defense and things like that. And it would take money, do need money to fix our cyber infrastructure and our security grids and things like that to basically secure our infrastructure and to basically build like a cyber defense apparatus. We can't get the budget to do that because they're like, we got to find a way to put a helicopter on top of a tank and that way it can fly around and fire. I mean, it's like the weapons we build, they don't match the threats we've actually got.
Yeah, and I think this kind of goes back to one of the flaws of democracy. It's difficult in a democracy to keep up with all of the changing threats that we face. Talking about cyber terrorism, half of these senators probably don't even know what cyber terrorism is. So, trying to get them to write legislation, read it, pass it, and by the time this goes through, we have a new threat, like a completely different threat. So,
I want you to think about this. The largest military in the world is the Chinese military. They have more troops, but they spend less. They have less weapons. Somehow they've got more troops than we do, but they spend less. And it's because when you look at their weaponry, they have one aircraft carrier that they bought from Russia at a discount. We have 12. In our heads, we're fighting the Chinese military. That's why we're building up all these weapons and all this stuff like this. And I'm like, you've got all this money going into weapons to fight Chinese, 12 aircraft carriers versus one, and meanwhile, a 12-year-old Ukrainian kid could wreck our whole fucking economy with a cyber attack. It's impossible to get them to understand that a teenage Ukrainian hacker could do more damage to us than the Chinese military. But he could. That's what they're not really getting.
And it's because they don't understand. There's so many politicians and congressmen that don't understand the real threat that's there.
I've written articles about it where if you really go through a list of America's enemies, we're in a lot better place with Obama than we ever have been.
Yeah.
Like, especially since Bush took office. So, like, I'll go through this real quick. Towards the end of the Bush presidency, Iraq was a mess. We were in total shambles. Since Obama's been president, we've left Iraq. Afghanistan, I don't think Afghanistan will ever be stable, but I think it's better off than when Obama took office. In Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, who actually was a sponsor of terrorism for decades, is dead. And even though, like, there's not a lot of law in Libya and it's kind of a mess or whatever, they're not really a threat internationally. Like, the different groups in Libya are so busy fighting each other that it's hard to really make that into a big threat. In Russia, low oil prices have basically crippled the Russian economy. Vladimir Putin's a lot more willing to deal than he was because their economy sucks so bad they can't take a new round of sanctions. Iran, we're in a lot better place than when Bush left office. We were talking about going to war with Iran and talking about them as being a big threat. Now we have a quasi-peace treaty with Iran. With Iran, I think Obama saw a real opportunity because their whole beef was about the Shah of Iran. Took over in the 50s, and then they overthrew him in the late 1970s. Well, late 70s were a long time ago, and you're basically talking about an entire two different generations that have been raised to not even remember the Shah of Iran. Basically, anybody under the age of 40 who lives in Iran is like, America's the devil is because of something that happened before you were born. It's hard to keep that going. You see Iran and it's like, the Shah, and I'm like, the Shah was in charge for 20 years and your Islamic revolution's been going on for damn near 40. When the thing you're complaining about lasted half of the time period since you've been in charge, like, there's got to be a certain half-life. There's got to be a statute of limitations going on. Even we didn't hate Britain forever. Move on, right? And, of course, the older establishment in Iran, they keep going back to the Shah so that nobody pays attention to what they've done for 40 years. The Islamic Revolution has abused the Iranian people worse than the Shah ever thought about. But they don't.
Yeah.
It's easier to scapegoat him, go back to this time period over and over again, than to be like, well, you've been in charge for 40 years, and you've still got massive civil rights abuses. What's your excuse? So I think he sees an opportunity there. The Cuba, probably the biggest no-brainer.
Oh, yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Fidel and Raul Castro, are they threats to America? No. Cuban embargo lasted 50 years, was a complete failure. I've argued before that it actually kept the Castros in power, because when you had America basically cut itself off from a country that's 90 miles from their border, you basically cut off American influence in their affairs.
Yeah.
And so the Castros, because they had an insulated economy, they didn't have an economy anymore. They basically became a sponsor state for Russia. And like different
yeah.
checks from Russia and Venezuela kept their economy afloat, indirectly keeping the Castros in power. So when it became, oh, well, Cuba doesn't have an economy, they're just a symbol of what the world can do against American imperialism, it became really important for Russia and Venezuela to keep the Castros in power and to keep their economy going. And, I mean, their entire economy just became like charity payments, basically. And I think if you had not had that embargo going on, I mean, if America had still been keeping business or whatever, I think they would have had a lot more direct influence. I honestly don't believe the Castros would still be in power if that embargo hadn't happened and hadn't gone on for 50 years.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. But, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's no way that somebody can look at the Cuban embargo and say, hey, that was a good idea.
I mean, it was not a wild success. And the only reason it was kept on for so long was because Florida is a swing state in the
yeah.
presidential elections, and they didn't want to lose Florida. This is kind of a little hard to explain. People say, well, why didn't the Cubans in Florida, why were they so against ending the embargo? And I think it's when the communist revolution happened in Cuba, they basically took over. They kicked out a lot of the people who had any money, and they kicked
yeah.
out a lot of people who had influence. So a lot of people who came to America were very right-wing, and very against communism and very anti-Castro. But a lot of them, because they'd all been kicked out or whatever, they didn't have, like, strong ties to Cuba anymore. And because a lot of the people in Miami and, like, South Florida, they're like the moneyed class of Cuba. It would basically be like if Bernie Sanders and his Sandinistas took over America and the Koch brothers and all these people. If the Sandinistas took over America and then the Koch brothers and Chill Madison all had to move to Israel, right? Or England or somewhere, right? They're like,
yeah.
you know, England or wherever it was. They don't really care, because the Koch brothers don't care about America now. And they live here, right? They don't really
yeah.
care if Americans starve to death, as long as they can get rid of the regime, as long as they can get rid of Sanders and the regime that kicked them out of the country. That's all they care about. They care about
yeah.
getting their money and their wealth and their power back. Big part of the Miami, like, power structure and base of South Florida, I know this can sound bad, but they weren't that concerned with the plight of your average Cuban, and they never really
yeah.
identified with those people anyway. And that's partly how the Castros came to power to start with, was because the moneyed class in Cuba had gotten so far detached from the life of, like, was poor, and they were making almost no money, while the moneyed class in Havana was rich because of the casinos and the hotels, the American mafia. Like, they kept this power structure in Havana really rich, and the income inequality became so bad. That's what led to the Castros taking power to begin with. So when all these wealthy Cubans wound up in Florida, they cared about keeping the blockade going, making Cuba as poor and destitute as possible, to get rid of the Castros. And basically, when they got rid of them, they could get all their money and land and power holdings back. And so they weren't really that concerned with your average Cuban starving to death or whatever. So there was a lot of poor refugees that wound up in Florida, but some of the early ones who fled in, like, in the 60s and started, you know, when you get to a country first, you get the most power.
Yeah.
A refugee coming on a raft in 2012 is not going to have the same influence as, like, the money class that all showed up in the early 60s. And they hated the Castros, hated them. And they didn't want to know America was doing any kind of business with them. And because Florida was such a swing state, like, if it had been Alabama, it wouldn't have mattered, because we know that they're going to go for the Republicans. So the first Democrat would have ended it. And Clinton almost ended the embargo. Bill Clinton tried to end it, and then a few things happened during his presidency that made it impossible. So Obama, he's like, enough's enough. And he's right. I mean, if you look at most American people and you ask them about ending the Cuban embargo, like, most of them are like, there's a Cuban embargo. But it's been going on so long, we've forgotten about it. The last time Cuba was any type of a real threat was the Cuban Missile Crisis, 13 days, and that was during the Kennedy administration. I mean, 50 years is a long time to hold a grudge.
Yeah, it is America. So we occasionally tend to hold grudges. People still are pissed off at Japan sometimes.
Well, they probably have more to be pissed off about at us than anything. And I think, if you segue it, I mean, Japan is still the only country in the world that's ever had a nuclear weapon deployed on them. And plus, during World War II, like, we had destroyed 50% of the entire country of Japan. It was destroyed by different bombings and missile raids and things like that. And they have their own things. I mean, they obviously committed a lot of atrocities in the Philippines and China and stuff. But when we talk about neocons, I mean, in a way, the atomic weapons kind of changed the game of warfare, because when they came up with atomic weapons, I mean, it's a bad thing in many, many ways, and there's too many countries that have nuclear weapons. I'd like to see Pakistan's nuclear weapons taken from them tomorrow. I mean, I don't feel very comfortable with, like, Pakistan and India, like, but they hate each other's gut. They both get nuclear weapons, especially Pakistan, which is not really stable and has no real way to secure them. I mean, I picture, like, Pakistan's nuclear silo to be looking like an American trash dump or something, and they, I guess they're around here somewhere. They might be in that cardboard box. Go check it out. There's like a homeless guy sleeping on top of one of their weapons or something. But North Korea, obviously, I mean, as we go on and on and on about the Middle East, you know, Kim's over there like, hey, I'm going to blow you all up. I'm going to blow you all up. You know, like, the world's like a family. The youngest kid's in all this trouble, and we're always like, oh, what are we going to do about Bradley? He's in jail all the time. And then my oldest son's like, I'm going to kill myself. Pay attention to me. Pay attention to me. Oh, that's great. That's not really listening to what he's saying. Nuclear weapons are bad in many, many ways, but they kind of changed the game in that it guaranteed that there wouldn't be a World War III unless it was the last war we ever had. Nuclear weapons made it to where there's no middle ground. It's either you don't have a war with a country like China or Russia, or we all die. Like, there's total planetary extinction, or you somehow find a way to get along with China without blowing them up, and that'll blow you up. The weapons that we build are really useless, because a major war like Russia and China, it's hard to believe we would get in a World War II style war and nuclear weapons wouldn't be deployed, in which case all this machinery we're building are useless, because it's all going to be nuclear rockets going back and forth.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that China is a threat in many, many ways, but I don't feel that threat, just because that the way countries are changing is that we now look at it more as like economic, right? So China would rather wage economic war than like a literal, like, China would look at it and be like, oh, boots on the ground, how passe, we're just going to wreck your economy. They would rather do like a economic war than like actually the tedious business of invading a place and managing it.
And that kind of goes back to, I mean, what we started with. How can you say, you know, whether or not we're safe when, you know, a lot of the wars that we're facing are things that it's not your traditional type of war. Cyber terrorism, economic war, things like that. I mean, our military is useless. What are we going to do? Like, send in a bunch of SEAL teams to kill off all these hackers? I mean, you've hacked into our economy. We're going to kill you.
Right, and I mean, General Petraeus, he kind of came up with the idea of counterinsurgency. He saw that the military was too, they were really too stuck in the Cold War ways. And it was basically like, if you keep trying to fight the Cold War, it's useless against the threats we have. So he kind of came up with this idea more about counterinsurgency. Like, instead of thinking about it as like a battleship game where there's different naval carriers out there in the Pacific and how do they not blow each other up, I mean, really the business of our current security is about taking a city in the Middle East and rooting out terrorists from it. And we had really forgotten how to do that, because everything was about blitzkriegs and dropping bombs and all this stuff. And we kind of don't know how to do it. I mean, when you look at the business of security and what needs to be done, it's a city in the Middle East, terrorists or an insurgent group have taken it over, and we have to reclaim it. And that's still something that we're struggling to really know how to master. And you can't get out of a problem like that with a new weapon. There's no new weapon that's going to do it. It's the tedious business of intelligence work. For all of the money that we're spending on weapons and stuff, a lot of that should be diverted to the CIA. And I know a lot of, like, liberals, the CIA, that's a four-letter word or whatever, but the true future of where we're at in terms of threats and security, it's all intelligence stuff. I mean, essentially, we're using the army to fight terrorist networks, and that's the wrong tool. Terrorist networks have to be fought with intelligence networks. A big army and a boots on the ground and all this kind of stuff, I mean, that only works if you're fighting another conventional army, which we're not.
Yeah.
We're fighting a transnational terrorist group of a few hundred people. And the only real way to really go about ending that is an intelligence network. It's the CIA.
Yeah.
It's different people who they've got sources. They can track wire payments. The military comes into it when they have a terrorist and they know the location. They send a drone or SEAL Team 6. But for the most part, having a standing army base of 50,000 troops or whatever, I mean, in a place like the Middle East, it's just not the right tool to really be fighting the situations we've got.
Yeah. And it's just asking for trouble, too.
Yeah, a terrorist group like ISIS, if you put the army in Syria, let's go to Iraq. And then you put the army in Iraq, I guess we'll hide out in Jordan. I mean, they can disperse and go places. I mean, that's why an intelligence network makes so much more sense, because if ISIS gets hammered in Syria, they're going to move to Iraq. If they get hammered in Iraq, they'll disperse. A quarter of them will go to Saudi Arabia. They'll get checks from Saudi Arabia. So you got to have you got to be able to trace Saudi Arabia bankers' wire payments. And it's all things people could think of as intelligence work. If they really get hammered, they'll send out a coded message to two guys living in Cincinnati who want to go to the mall in Cincinnati and shoot it up or something. And then who has to intercept that? An intelligence network. So it all has to come back to, like, there's signals intelligence, which the NSA does, where they intercept phone calls. Then there's also human intelligence, where you develop a literal source. And that's the kind of things that you really have to use to be able to dismantle and disrupt terrorist networks, not so much like troops and 100 tanks into a place that they could leave. ISIS is not going to be like, we'll fight you. You know, they're going to disperse and leave. The second we invaded Afghanistan, the entire Al-Qaeda infrastructure moved to Pakistan. I mean, it's like... Unless they're confined to a country, like there's an invisible wall around Afghanistan and they can't leave or something.
Donald Trump's listening is like, if I was president, I'd build a wall around Afghanistan.
Like the first day, we're going to build the wall around Mexico. 2 weeks later, he comes back, his ties are done. He's like, turns out we can't. So we're going to build it around Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And we're going to make sure that those terrorists stay trapped there.
Yeah.
And then they build the wall in Afghanistan. And then after that, like, it just makes it harder for China to have to invade when they have to. Every empire eventually gets their turn in Afghanistan, right? So it's like you got either out of the grade all the way to the Russians, and then now it's our turn, and then pretty soon, like 100 years from now, Brazil will be like, oh, what are we going to do about Afghanistan? And they've got to go in there and invade or something. I mean, every big country has to spend resources and time in this country that is useless. You know what? I would actually support Trump's Afghanistan wall. Wall them off. Leave them there. Make it where nothing can come or go out. Like, I feel like that's, you know, like you just get to a point where there's that building that you can't do anything with, and they just throw a tarp over it or something. Like, they just sort of cover a room. Like, there's that room that you can't do anything. Like, you just cover it up with a tarp. I feel like we should, like, what if we did that? Just put a giant tarp over Afghanistan. We're like, okay, we're going to leave it here, cover it up, and then move out and have it be that way. And I feel like the people of Afghanistan, they'd be like, good.
Yeah.
Finally, the tarp. And then they're like the angry spouse thing. Well, we knew America would leave, but they don't have to cover us up. Like, they're ashamed of us or something. Knew it wasn't going to last forever, but...
Treating us like we treat our women.
You know, the American military is like, we've decided a new tactic for Afghanistan. We're going to psychologically humiliate them by making the men wear burqas. We're going to put the men in burqas, and we're going to demoralize them in that way. So I feel like we got to start doing that. Like, we got to start, like, psychologically unraveling people. Like, just start, like, thing with them and stuff. Trump was like, what did he say? Something about they put the bullets in pig's blood before they shoot the Taliban because the pig thing, like, it would bother them. Something like the pork products. I can just think like the Taliban guy, he gets shot and, like, he gets shot but he's not dead. He's got 5 seconds. I can't believe there's pig's blood in me right now. And he just, like, dies. He's like, on his tombstone, it says he died humiliated or something. And Trump's like, I showed that asshole. There's one flaw of liberals, I think, is that we sometimes project the way we are onto other people. People in the Middle East, they're not a different species or anything than America. But I think that historically, and I don't know, there may be a little bit more about force and fear and things like that is maybe more important, maybe a different emphasis on it. Like, if you read, like, a fairy tale, like, you know, an American fairy tale, at the end of it's like, and Cinderella found her prince.
Yeah.
If you can read, like, a nice tune fairy tale, it's like, and then he had his revenge. The princess beheaded her accuser, and everything was good in the village. And it was, I mean, it's like, the whole stories are about revenge and blood oaths and feuds, and, like, you finally satisfy your father's quest for revenge on this rival family. And so I think we project this thing onto a different place. Like, oh, they think how we think, and all we got to do is get them some self-driving cars and a Starbucks, yeah, and they're gonna be good to go. People respond to force. It's fear-based. But we don't think about it that way because we're so used to fighting people who are, you know, you got to keep in mind, for a long, long time, America fought enemies that were basically like us. I mean, you had the British Empire, and then the Germans in World War II, and then Russia during the Cold War and stuff. So we're finding people who kind of think similar to how we do in advanced societies and things like that. And then you get over to the Middle East, and it's like, okay, we're going to fight, and they're like, we're going to cut your heads off. It's like, what? This is a tactic? It's like Americans over there are like, okay, we need to convene the War Crimes Tribunal, and we're going to take this guy to The Hague. And then they're like, oh, we're going to put a bunch of women in a cage and set it on fire. It's like, oh, that's a little different than how we do things. I mean, it's a little different than how we think about it. But we do that. We try to project onto people how we're like it. Sometimes I'm not saying that it's, like, a lot of neocons will say things like, oh, the Middle East is not ready for democracy. They can't have a democracy. And I'm like, well, that's easy for you to say because you're not being asked to live in an oppressive society. Basically, like, you're not being asked to live dictatorships. So I'm not saying that. I don't think that there's anything innately, like, the white gene doesn't come with democracy embedded in the genetic code. Like, there's nothing about why people that were just more predisposed to democracy in Africa and the Middle East, they can't figure it out. But there is something in the Middle Eastern culture that I think maybe responds to strength a little bit more. And I'm not saying it's going to be fascist strength. I'm not saying it's going to be like the guy can't be democratically elected because he's a badass, right? But you can be a badass and be a democratically elected badass. Yeah. I think if you had like a real, like if there was a militia group or something in Afghanistan, or there was something that people respected, like there was a guy who was a badass and he could kill the Taliban, but he was also like, and people respected him and they trusted him and they didn't think he'd be corrupt, they would democratically elect him.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's absolutely. Just that right now they look at it and there's no good options. People have to have a George Washington or a Teddy Roosevelt, or got to have that figure.
Yeah.
And it just comes down to one day there'll be a guy who's in the right place at the right time. If you go back to the early American Revolution, if you had had, say, George Bush over George Washington, I think we'd have I don't know if America would be the place it is now. Like, no. You have to get the right guy at the right moment at the right time. But if you'd have had, like, a really corrupt, just somebody people didn't trust, or he was corrupt, and that had been the first president. And let's say that George Washington had said, you know, he could have been president for a lot longer than two terms. But the two-term thing, that only came about after FDR. That wasn't even part of the
Constitution.
People didn't have to quit after two terms. They just did. But George Washington was like, no, I'm going to do two terms. I'm going to step down. People are going to elect somebody else. If you had, let's say, Dick Cheney is the first president, he's like, I'm going to be president for life, you know. I mean, it would be a different place. And part of it is, like, whenever we had the right people at the right time, and because they were getting away from King George and this type of, like, lifelong monarchy, it was really important that they do things democratically and they do it the right way and they instill checks and balances. Like, because they were running away from federal power and they were running away from, like, a dictatorship, basically. I mean, a monarchy is just another word for a dictatorship. Because they were running away from that, that's what made America the place it was. And then now, 250 years later, we're still afraid of federal power, which we're going to get to in the next podcast, where we talk about libertarianism. We're almost too afraid of, we want things to be almost so free that we have a government that doesn't function. Because we want things to, like, you can never do anything at the federal level, and there's got to be, you know, so it's almost dysfunctional because we were so attached to that idea of individual freedom. But it had to happen that way at the beginning. People always paint Obama as like this feckless foreign policy failure. I mean
it's an election season, so and so obviously we've got to go through the whole Obama's terrible on foreign policy. He's been a failure at foreign policy. But at the same time, I mean, like you said, we're in such a better place now than we were 8 years ago. Are we safe? You know, who knows? I gotta believe that there's a lot of things going on that we don't know about, that the government doesn't want us to know about. So who knows if we're actually safe? I think we are. But at the same time, I think that there are plenty of threats out there that we should be addressing that we're not addressing, like some of the ones that we talked about. So, I mean, as far as from being invaded by an army, I think we're safe. As far as having our economy wrecked or cyber terrorist attack or something like that, I don't think we're that safe. So,
one of the big beasts of the neocons is that Obama is wanting to leave the Middle East. That's one of their big, big complaints. and they've talked a lot about, you know, yeah. Well, they talked a lot about he's abandoned Iraq and he's not wanting to intervene in Syria, and Saudi Arabia complains that he doesn't want to help them in their ongoing, you know, blood feud with Iran and stuff, and he's trying to make peace with Iran. He's basically trying to leave the Middle East. Obama thinks the future's in Asia. I do too.
Yeah.
I really do too. I can't agree more. And even if you looked at like countries that are war torn and they have a lot of natural resources, I always say Africa. Look at that. Because to me, there's stuff that the Middle East has got that Africa doesn't have. And Africa is kind of, I mean, I thought about this, I interviewed somebody a couple of weeks ago, a Nigerian activist, that in terms of terrorist groups, Boko Haram is deadlier than ISIS. In 2015, they killed more people than ISIS did.
Yeah.
Kenya is a relatively stable country, yet Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist network, they're trying to disrupt it. Nigeria is not even at war, unlike Syria. I mean, ISIS usually moves into Syria or Iraq or places that's already at war. Nigeria is not at war. It's not normal what they're doing, basically. Like, it's not business as usual. So if you look at the real future, the not just oil, but like the rare minerals that we use for technology and chips, the rare minerals that are being used for electronics and robotics, Africa has a bigger supply of that than the Middle East does. And I think there's a real dichotomy. The Middle East has basically said, get out, we don't want you. Like, I think they've made their feelings about America quite clear. And so they're basically like, we don't want you here. And Africa's basically like, please come. They said that they would like investment. And China's been very perceptive of this. China is now basically taking over the entire continent of Africa in terms of investments and foreign power and like building infrastructure and making deals with governments. And so it looks like America's just fucking stuck in this bad marriage, this failed relationship with the Middle East where nothing we do is right. If they want us to do more. And then China has basically had this great love affair with Africa, and they're showing up, scooping up all these investments, and it looks like they're doing it the right way. And I think Obama's tried to steer us away from the Middle East into a little bit more investing in Africa, and especially investing more in Asia, which is what he sees as the real future, which is true. But
I think it'd be almost impossible to get America to go along with Obama if he says, we're going to invest in Africa, though. But they'd be like, finally, he's admitted he's from Africa.
Yeah, like all the African immigrants be like, hooray, and then everybody else would be like, what? What's going on, you know? So Saudi Arabia, they're very unhappy with Obama. They're basically wanting him to leave. Obama's trying to get relations better with Iran, which is Saudi Arabia's big blood enemy. They'll never get along with Iran, basically. But just because Saudi Arabia wants us to get along with Iran, it doesn't mean it's the right thing for us to do.
Yeah.
I mean, our relationships with those countries should stay good and stay strong. There's got to be a balance. Like, we can't get sucked into the blood feuds of the Middle East or the world and never leave, as we've proven with Iraq. I mean, it's just never going to be. Well, Saudi Arabia particularly, they have a lot of influence because there's been articles about how some Saudi Arabian diplomats have been tied to the 9/11 hijackers. And they're basically saying that if there's been this big brouhaha in the news about how if the 9/11 families, if they're able to sue Saudi Arabia for damages, Saudi Arabia's threatening to pull out like $750 billion. They've got something like $750 billion invested in America. They're going to pull it out and sink our economy. So I think like we're seeing that the future is we're never going to probably have a war with Saudi Arabia, but economically, just pulling out their assets could sink our economy. After China, they're one of the countries that owns debt in America. They call that in. They sink our economy. So I think you're seeing it to where, because of a truly globalized economy, wars, they were fought over religion. They were fought over, like, nationality, and we'll still have that. But wars have also been fought over resources, usually.
Yeah.
And people, our border should be here, and you say it should be there. We want this, and you've got it. We're going to take this from you. In a truly globalized economy, you're almost looking at war as like an anachronism, because a corporation can go into this country and basically take it over without an American boot ever stepping foot on, like an American military boot ever stepping foot there. So you're looking at it more and more to where the armies of the future are going to be corporations. They're going to be like boardrooms and lawyers, and Saudi Arabia's like, well, we'll just pull out all of our investments. You're going to win more that way than you ever could with a standing army invading a place.
Yeah.
Russia's, I know they invaded Ukraine or whatever, but I mean, Russia's not in a military position to do any real damage to any place. Their military is incredibly weak in general. But what they could do is wreak enough havoc on oil prices that it gets people to cry uncle. And that's what you're going to start seeing more and more of. The biggest threat to America is it's not even an army, it's OPEC.
Yeah.
You're going to see more and more of that. And Saudi Arabia, they've even invested in a lot lot of American think tanks. And people understand now you can hire lobbying firms and you can fund think tanks. And so whenever you go on the Washington Post and you see Obama's abandoned the Middle East, Obama's deal with Iran, some of that's Saudi Arabian money because they've been able to finance think tanks and lobbying groups and different efforts around Washington, D.C. That's kind of fit into this idea that Iran is dangerous, Iran's bad, Iran's this. If you work as a chief of staff for a congressman, and then he loses his job, one of your first places to go is a think tank right across the street that's going to hire you to be there, and that's being funded with Saudi Arabian money. It's actually a really good investment because think tanks, by and large, are broke compared to lobbying firms, and Saudi Arabia, if they can write a $100,000 check, which is nothing to them, it's everything to a think tank. That's like three employee salaries because they don't pay a lot. And they fund that over there, and they've essentially bought a year's worth of good pieces that are going to go in different magazines and newspapers and different places like that that are basically going to make the case for America to become closer to Saudi Arabia and America not to abandon them and America to leave Iran and don't trust Iran. And that feeds into a perception. And most congressmen get their news from these think tanks being funded by Saudi Arabian money. It's a great way to have influence, basically indirect influence over congresspeople, which sometimes you can't approach directly because of different rules. It's a great roundabout way to basically influence John McCain to believe that Iran evil because he's getting his information from a staffer who used to work for him that's now at a think tank that's now being funded by a check from Saudi Arabia. But if a Saudi Arabia diplomat directly came to him, he'd be like, I'm not going to get played. I'm too smart for you. If they go around, if they use like three different steps to go around it and fund it that way, then it's like, Iran is evil. Let's blow them up. But if a Saudi Arabia, if a Saudi Arabian guy directly said that to him, I'm not falling for your tricks.
Yeah.
They figured out that the new armies are lobbying firms and corporations and money and influence and think tanks. I mean, this is the new warfare. Michael, what's your web address for us?
BlueInAlabama.wordpress.com.
And of course, you can find me at AlabamaLiberal.com. Join us next week when we shall talk a little bit about California as well as the final part of our trilogy about small government libertarianism. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody.